Cool. So what I've got to do is actually press a bunch of buttons here because we are a one-man show, Adam. Hence, I've got to do kind of everything here. Okay, I think we should be live, which is fantastic. Just a quick sound check, folks. Anybody, basically, we are multicasting this on Crowdcast right now, but we're also going live out on LinkedIn, I believe, as well as Periscope, which is somehow still up, despite the fact that it's saying they were going to shut it down in April, as April 1st. And we're also live streaming, I believe, on the Facebook group as well. So what I need people to do, if you can hear this, can you please give me some indication that sound is okay? Let me know. I'm going to check my mobile just to make sure that's fine. But if you do hear this okay, just give me a thumbs up, thumbs down, something like that. Let me know that you can hear me fine. Okay, thank you, Stephen. Very good. At least Crowdcast is working. I think we've got a few on Facebook as well, which is cool. Also, I believe LinkedIn is working fine. Okay, great. Thank you very much for that bit of sound keeping, folks. Do appreciate it. We are doing Founders Focus again. So welcome back from the Easter break. Founders Focus is the interview show where we get up close and personal with the leaders of the tech businesses that are changing the way in which we work. And today I'm really pleased to be speaking with a leader of a business in a category that I really want to see completely win, because holy crap, the logistics involved in sorting out meetings and sorting out interviews and stuff like that has been the bane in recruitment, I think, since forever. So if we can get companies in there to sort this out, then all the better. And one of the most impressive products I've seen so far is Chronify. So welcome to the show, CEO of Chronify, Adam Bird. Adam, good to meet you, sir.
Likewise, thanks, hon.
So you're a busy CEO. You're launching a product in a really exciting category. What kind of things did you have to cancel in order to appear on Founders Focus today, Adam?
There's always many, many plates. There's a few plates wobbling behind me right
Baking
now,
some
but it's
lemon muffins or something.
No, my baking days are kind of are over, I think, but maybe in a few years' time.
Very seriously though, what did you have to reschedule? I'd be interested to know what the day in the life of a CEO actually looks like these days, especially one at your stage where you're just kind of to the point where takeoff is happening. What actually do you get involved in? Is it completely crazy, or do you have the time to organize your day in a more sensible way?
I guess I do kind of manage my calendar quite carefully. It's given what I do, it's the last thing I need to do is have a turn up late for anything. With what we do in terms of powering scheduling, and if I ever turn up late for everything, it's kind of embarrassing kind of a thing. So, but yeah, I guess I'm a very product focused CTO, a CEO. So I was the CTO in my last company. A very product focused CEO. So I spend a lot of my time with customers, with the product team, with the engineering team, really trying to distill what it is we can power. And whilst I come from a very technical background myself, and hence we've delivered this very much as an API first product. And this, if you like, the scheduler is the latest iteration of that. I've worked with companies across a range of sectors, not just recruitment, in really trying to distill scheduling down to its essence. And of course, that's the bit I love doing. But then the other side of being a CEO of a startup is kind of everything you haven't got anyone else to do. So it's chief doer of things, and picking up of pieces is the other aspect of a early stage CEO's job.
That's actually a really interesting thread I want to pick up on. But you actually made a joke early on in your little monologue there, Adam, and I realized how actually significant it really is. You can't ever be late for anything, can you? That's like no excuse. So,
No.
folks, if you didn't know, Chronify is, I mean, as you say, API-driven products, and potentially could be lots of things. But right now, what people know it for and probably use it most for is to sort out scheduling. So that puts some like mega pressure onto you and all of your team, I guess, is like you've just got to be bang on, like never make this mistake. So anyway, good discipline. Let's pick up the thread about a CEO having to do stuff you don't like to do. I think one of the truisms in life is that you end up naturally defaulting to things that you enjoy. And you do more of those things you enjoy, therefore you get better at it. Once you get competence increase that thing, actually the enjoyment typically gets better, and you've got this virtuous circle there. Correspondingly, you get a vicious circle also. You neglect things that you don't like doing. You do them like, you know, episodically, and you don't get better at them without like really training yourself. How do you cope with that, Adam? Because your role must have like dramatically changed, right? Going from engineer, then CTO with your previous business, and now CEO, which, you know, potentially could be a zero technical job. So how do you train yourself to, I've got to look at this spreadsheet, or I've got to do this deck. How do you train yourself to do that?
I think there's it's kind of a sense of responsibility. I think, you know, I've got older, gray hair, and you kind of realize actually, you know, back to your job is to spin plates, certainly in the early stage. And sometimes those plates will drop, but you've got to decide to make sure that those plates that drop are low value plates. And actually there is, certainly for me, going from a kind of technical product focus to becoming a company leader, actually my attention really has to dive kind of move over to, my job is to build the company, not the product. And thinking about the company in terms of the whole job is a really important kind of framing, and something that I've kind of used over the past few years to, I love development with no distractions, but that's just not my life anymore. This idea that you run your own company to be master of your own destiny is kind of a bit made up. Yeah, you've always got stakeholders. You've always got someone who has demands on you. And so really, you have to kind of just accept that your masters are different. They're not necessarily someone telling you what to do directly. There are just, you know, payroll has to get signed off. I have a finance team to do that. But all these things have to happen in order to develop a business. And I guess what I've become very focused on is what I can automate, what I can, you know, delegate, automate, but not delegate in the term in the way of saying just let someone else, not in terms of abdicate, is how can we run the company more efficiently so we're just not spending our time on admin. And no one should be spending their time on admin. You know, everyone should be spending their time on high value tasks, really. And so an invoice run should be an automated thing. A support ticketing should be an automated thing. This kind of trying to provision as much as possible automatically, which means the whole team are doing that. And I guess that, you know, in many ways that comes through to kind of how we build our products. And the idea is that people like recruiters shouldn't be spending their time doing admin. Recruiters are people. They spend their time identifying the best people, the best fit for the role. That's what you should be wanting them to do. As soon as they're doing mindless paperwork, in the same way that salespeople rail against keeping the CRM up to date, always looking for ways to automate. And I guess that's where my kind of engineering mindset is quite beneficial, is that I don't like doing the same thing twice. And if I can avoid it, I will.
I was about to say the engineering mindset, discipline, maybe even nature, if you like. Some people, I think, are naturally attuned to have this type of focus, may help you run a super efficient business in that respect. Because if it is something that, you know, it annoys you to have to redo stuff, and that expenditure
annoyance
of time
is a good word. Yeah.
Wasn't it Bill Gates that said something like this? I forget who it was. Some sort of iconic ex-engineer turned CEO said something to that effect, where, you know, they're actually looking for, and it was a joke, I don't think he really meant it this way, but he was looking for like people who were inherently lazy, I think was the term. And I don't think he was trying to make the point, but his description of lazy is someone who just is annoyed at having to repeat, because that person is going to look for a solution that can scale. And with the technical know-how, maybe they can go ahead and do that. So fascinating to see you transition to this. There's been a bunch of engineers turn into CEOs. I don't know whether you saw the other, but a lot of articles on it. I think the did a comparison, didn't they, about the biggest companies in the world in terms of market value in 2021 compared to 1991 or something. And obviously big shift from like oil essentially to tech. And all of the tech businesses, apart from one or two, I think were all ran by ex-engineers. And then there was this kind of thinking, oh, you know, is there something inherent about being an engineer which makes them a good CEO? Your thoughts on this, Adam, is there something about engineering that makes you a good CEO? Or do you think it's more a case of, look, the entire world's just got more technical and it so happens that the people who are building those types of companies have become, you know, the CEOs as a course of a trend rather than any inherent characteristic?
It does feel like this sort of company, successful company culture is leaning into successful engineering culture. So if you look at, so around about 2000, the Agile Manifesto came out in software engineering. And this idea of about getting software engineers really close to customers, as close to customers as possible, and providing a framework for them to deliver value incredibly quickly and safely. And then you kind of fast forward and you look at the kind of leaders of Netflix, for example, Reed Hastings, ex-engineer, and their entire culture, as far as I can see, is around doing exactly that, getting people as close to customers as possible, giving them a framework to deliver value as quickly as possible, and empowering them to do that, and a kind of safety net of being able to do that really, really quickly, and therefore iterate. So I think naturally, I think engineers and engineering leaders who are at the early stages of that agile revolution in software development, where it moved from like ship once a quarter and hopefully everything's fine to ship every hour, and you know pretty much it's that those three lines of code you just shipped are the ones that have broken everything, makes that whole process far easier to do far more quickly. So I think it's natural that as people start to apply that to larger organizations, people are reflecting on actually we can kind of remove the barriers between people and customers and remove the barriers to people delivering value. And I think probably the last 12 months have seen an acceleration in that, because part of the development approach is very much, you kind of almost forced to be outcome driven. The manner by which engineers build things is kind of irrelevant as long as the checks and balances are replaced and they're following process and they get that value out there. And I think what we've done with everyone or a large swathe of the community moving to remote working is managers have had to start to be very outcome driven. The idea of just looking over someone's shoulder and seeing whether they're in and getting a feel for whether they're working just doesn't work over Zoom. So naturally, I think organizations have started to embrace that idea around empowering people to deliver value in a safe way have come through this last 12 months far more successfully than those that haven't. There's been less to be like relearn, and really they're doubling down on that approach to culture, which whether or not, I guess my hope is that then moves out to all sorts of industries. And there's some argument that every company is a tech company, don't know, but fundamentally I think this approach to empowering people and giving them the framework to be successful in a supportive way is how companies will survive the net, you know, flourish in the next 10, 20 years.
I think that's so well put, Adam. You know, the idea that there's a lot of ideas that seem to have bled out from engineering into the wider business world, which is fascinating. Agile being probably the most obvious one, but not the only. If you think about things like, you know, being data driven, for instance, that was happening in tech, you know, 5-10 years before anybody in recruiting certainly was thinking about it. Or about open source, you know, very much tech driven, obviously, you know, most applied there. But now everyone, you know, in our industry, HR recruiting, they're talking, yeah, we should open source everything and, you know, allow things to happen via community sourcing rather than some sort of strategic direction. So it is very interesting to see how this happens. And I think you're right, with the shift to remote, this short, sharp shock everyone has received, we've had to shift away from, you know, we've had to super focus on what is being shipped effectively, if one who's engineering speak. That is the judgment of how things work. So yeah, maybe maybe leadership in engineering does translate to the new world of work if these ideas seem more ideas. Parallel processing, for instance, is another classic example where engineers have understood that actually one of the ways you can do things efficiently is that you don't have to do everything sequentially. Whereas in recruiting has always been an annoyingly sequential process, in my view, you know, where it's just a, basically an A, B, C, D, E of events that have to go in that order. And it is, we call it a pipeline and we force people through it. But we need to rethink, hey, is it possible to modularize that and chop it up into different bits and potentially parallel process some of those things? Anyway,
I think there's also a move, certainly in the tech industry, to more transparency. And I can see that happening more in other organizations as well. This idea that you kind of present everything. Now, you know, there's some organizations, and again, in the tech industry, that have been kind of almost hyper transparent about everything. So someone like Buffer, for example, share absolutely everything, internal salaries, payroll, the whole, everything they're doing, which, yeah, it's an interesting approach, not necessarily one I subscribe to completely, but this idea about presenting who you truly are to your stakeholders, I think is fundamentally important, because again, it creates this, this situation where it's this framework for trust and the framework for support that people can, they don't have to second guess what they should be sharing. We do the right things. We have the principles around which we operate. So therefore we can share that. And that speaks volumes in the recruitment, because what you want to do is you want to attract people who kind of fit and work in that similar way and can be successful around your company principles, and articulating those principles is so, so important. And so actually the best way of doing that is just, this is in our case, who Chronify is. This is how we operate. This is how we do things. And if you think you'll fit in here, we'd love to talk to you. And almost that's the pitch. And, but it becomes very much a two-way, you know, candidates can pre-qualify Chronify as much as we can pre-qualify the candidate.
Which is what we want, isn't it? I mean, at the end of the day, we want to make sure that the fit is, it's a win-win exchange, because it's either win-win or lose-lose. There's no like scenario where the employer wins and the employee loses in this regard, because both parties are losing, really. I think this, people might call it radical transparency these days, which is, you know, open door, open garage policy, work in the open, basically. Don't wait until you've finished it before you tell anybody about it. You know, work it through in public. And then, you know, potentially expose yourself for feedback early on. It's another version of being super agile, in the sense that you're building something, a process, a tool, even a recruiting strategy. Why should that be locked in the garage? Open it out. And then if it's flawed, it will be critiqued by the community before it's out there.
You'll know early before you've made the big investment.
Exactly. And you'll take the pressure off, you know, instead of this big launch, which, again, using engineering speak, previously was this, you know, quarterly shipping, which was hugely stressful. If anybody was in engineering,
pressing the CD. Yeah.
Exactly. Back in those days, you know, like the yearly release kind of thing. Oh, my goodness. What is the stress involved there? But instead of doing that, you simply constantly are open and then allowing people to come in if they want, and it transforms the communication you have with the audience. Quick segue. Do you remember when Stack Overflow used to do a live stream of their office? This is some time ago. This is when Spolsky was still there. It was like the most boring live stream ever. I mean, it was like nothing going on. A bunch of people occasionally walking across a whiteboard. But it was actually a really good like signal of intent, and it was pretty genuine in the sense, yes, stuff could happen there, and it would not be scheduled, it would not be pre-planned or edited or whatever. It would actually be the thing going on. You could trust it, therefore. Big part of the reason, by the way, why everything Brainfood it does is completely live, because I want to create the trust. I want you to know that, hey, this is, we're having a conversation. This is not edited. It's not going to be, you know, post-production. we look as we look. There's no filters here.
Haircuts are available next week in the UK, so here's hoping.
Your hair's looking very good, Adam, I have to say.
Only from a particular angle. As long as I don't go outside, it's fine.
Your head's got to be locked looking at the screen like this. Okay, yeah. Very good. Tell us about how Chronify started, Adam, because you engineer when you started, you set up a few things. There was a software development business to begin with. Then it was a product again, and then Chronify. When did the idea of Chronify start emerging in your mind?
Well, I guess the idea emerged as I became a leader of my previous company. My calendar was constant battle. Scheduling was a constant battle. This is the days pre-Calendly. Tungle tried this, pre-Sunrise. And there were a few attempts, but my calendar never really reflected my working life. And so I wrapped up my time with Ascendex and was thinking, okay, what do I do? What annoys me? Back to that powerful word and a powerful motivator, annoyance. And taking an engineering approach to it, I realized the problem with calendars and scheduling for me wasn't about UX, which most people were focusing on. You know, how do you create a nice booking experience? The problem actually was, how do you allow data to flow between applications in a way that protects people's security and privacy? That was the fundamental, and so I'm very much a back end engineer in terms of my thinking and the way I visualize problems. And so I convinced Gary, who we'd met a few years ago at a kind of networking event I started in Nottingham for the tech industry, and he'd been off doing other great things, but we stayed in touch and convinced him to leave his role as lead engineer at Zopa. Say let's solve this calendar problem. You know, how hard can it be? Turns out that there's kind of a lot to it. But really, the kind of initial focus is, okay, right, well, we need to solve the underlying connectivity issues and build this kind of platform upon which we can then build the technology to solve the problems. And actually, the first problem we addressed was, okay, well, how do the software we use on a day-to-day basis get access to my calendar in a way that, again, back to that security privacy, can't just ruin my life by deleting my calendars inadvertently, deleting my events inadvertently, that kind of thing. And so we built an API. Now, I've been building APIs since 2002, since way before they were cool. And so I've made an awful lot of mistakes. I was able to bring a lot of that learning. And I think this is one of the key things that I bring as a technical CEO to Chronify, is we are fundamentally at heart a technical product. We're solving very, very technical problems. But this ability to kind of map them onto end user problems is, if you like, that's our killer feature as an organization. And so we started working with a number of organizations. I think Skyscanner were an early customer. So they had like a travel concierge product and a few kind of marketplaces and online booking apps, and really started to see traction, but especially in HR and interview scheduling. And this then, oh yes, trying to schedule meetings interviews with engineers, absolute nightmare. And that was like, it was almost that kind of light bulb that this would be a big sector for us, and this was, you know, some clear value here in us solving these problems. But what I recognized is, again, that we could have then gone off and built, we'll build an interview scheduling solution. And the realization was, well, we're just creating yet another island, another sort of place where information has to fit. Let's work with the software vendors who actually already have those relationships, are already solving that problem, and have perhaps been unable to provide that end-to-end solution to their users because of the kind of complexities of integrating with calendars and the complexities of, you know, all the variety of scheduling use cases and sequences of meetings and assessment days and optional groups and round robin and everything else. We can provide all the technology to allow that to happen. Then our customers can just embed that into their application. And so their users are, they're in their ATS, they have their candidate, they can immediately just share a self-serve link with a candidate and never have to leave their flow. And that's a really, really important aspect of the way Chronify is built, is people shouldn't have to leave their flow in order to use it.
I love the clarity of vision with that, Adam, and also the clarity of the sort of the customers that you're addressing and who they're dealing with and what have you. That's I think one of the biggest challenges of problem solving is choosing and keeping your focus on which particular problem to solve, because there's endless numbers of them. Probably have competence at knocking a few of these down, but in order to execute on a great product that is really useful, it's you've got to really boil it down to that one or two things that you're doing. I absolutely love the focus there. Take us a little bit further down this journey, Adam. So you and Gary were building this thing. You got an app there. You got a few customers going. Was it Chronify at this stage? Was it already a business? Or was it just two developers saying, yeah, we can build something?
So I guess we onboarded our first customers in late 2015. I'm trying to think who was in the team then. I think we hired an SDR to do some kind of initial outreach just to kind of experiment with that. We had a marketing person who was generating content. Certainly knew that, had an inkling that trying to sell an API product was going to be a hard thing to do. And we have tried over the years as well, this idea that you kind of take a sales-driven approach to finding new customers, perhaps some outbound. But certainly I recognized from my Sendex days, which is fundamentally an API business as well. So we were a text messaging service provider, sort of 6,500 customers across Europe and Australia. And very much, we launched our first API in 2002, and very much that kind of subtended everything. They, you know, people like Ocado, Addison Lee, Sodexo were just using us as part of the core part of their workflow, Virgin Media for you. But these decisions around integrations are not taken lightly, and they're not something that necessarily a salesperson can force. And that's what you want from a sales team, is you want the ability to drive a sales process, to affect change in sales velocity, or acquire more customers. And actually what I think we've learned over the years, which we kind of knew, but you always question, and that's always the point of trying different things, is that actually what we had to be doing is just there for our customers, listen, support them, use our content marketing and our knowledge of the sector in order to drive adoption and demonstrate that we understood the underlying problem. So for example, in interview scheduling, you know, we don't talk about development hours saved for calendar synchronization. The product managers that we're talking to care more about, how do I reduce the time my users are spending on admin? How do I improve the candidate experience? And how do I reduce the time to hire? And it's okay, so what do we need to do in terms of our content? What do we need to do in terms of our product to allow people to solve that problem quickly and easily? And so then when they reach that point in their development roadmap where, okay, Q2 is about solving scheduling, we're the single best answer for doing that. And there's a whole cultural element to this as well, being, you know, we spend a lot of time being deliberate about maintaining speed. So we'll often go slow to go fast. This idea, okay, well, we'll try and do things as the minimum. It's an interesting balance. It's kind of, we have this idea of this principle, pragmatism on the way to perfection. And so we would love to build beautiful things that are just are perfect. Unfortunately, we don't have infinite time. So what we all, and like the key things we do on a day-to-day basis as a team, is probably the principle that people turn to the most is thinking, okay, what can I do that solves the problem but doesn't preclude me from solving this problem better in the future? And so, and this is where working with this API first approach is kind of building up this ability and talking to our customers and understanding how they're looking to solve the problem and then distilling that down. So maybe we've had to give a lot of handholding to this level of customer, but the next customers just have it that little bit easier. So we're constantly iterating all the time. And so what this has meant is as an organization, as we started rolling out, we've kind of built up this momentum, if you like, in, and people recognize that Chronify is powering the interview scheduling in, you know, the apps they're using, the top sort of ATSs in the world, and increasingly more. And that's because we've recognized our position is not to try and force people to use it, is to provide the best possible solution and be there when they're ready to use it.
Yeah. Again, I'm really, I say impressed as if I'm anybody to judge you or your business. I'm not, I'm just the dude, right? But I'm really impressed by the understanding of the sales strategy that you need to adopt for this type of product. Because there's a gap between the person who gets the benefit from the product from the versus the person who actually purchases it, and that is often just a kind of a thicket that a salesperson is not going to be able to chop through, and simply won't have the skill set or the right degree of knowledge in the different buckets in order to do that. So going by your approach, I think is super smart, and you know, hopefully a nicer way to kind of build business in a sense, because you know the worst thing we want to see, I don't know, I get demoralized by the idea of having a staff of like 25 people in sales and just hammering out 1,000 calls a day. You know, that kind of approach probably is done its day and we need to move away from it. And in the end, you know, by being an API play, you've got a real chance of scaling out super quickly if you get the breakthroughs with the right partners and the right companies that work with your software. So, you know, that's a very exciting thing.
Yeah, but also I think what we've been doing recently with the if you think of our product as a series of layers, we've actually introduced a very top layer where actually it's a plugin to Outlook and Gmail, which is again used by recruiters. So would you believe there are some ATSs that don't use Chronify for scheduling? Crazy, I know, but they don't. Yet customers still want all that capability. So we've shipped a plugin for Gmail and Outlook and various other applications. And actually the value in that is, yes, we've distilled everything we've learned about scheduling over the years into a product that anyone can use, but it gets us that bit closer to our customers. Now, for me, in my perfect world of my perfect vision for how scheduling should happen, you shouldn't need that. It should just be baked into the application. But pragmatism on the way to perfection. Yeah, this is a really excellent way of solving the problem right now and quickly, but also gets us closer to customers again. So any recruiters who are using it, we're constantly learning about how real people are using it, which then allows us to, okay, well, if we kind of enable this API capability here, then all of these software companies can take advantage of it as well. So it's a really, for me as a product person, it's the best job in the world. It's great. I get to kind of, you know, just work out where these things should be fitting.
That's right. And you get your customers to do the thinking and doing for you. And they can prove it as they're going. So, you know, those little apps that give that small bit of functionality to these customers, I presume you might just ship this for free, these plugins on Gmail, Outlook or whatnot. Yeah. Anybody download, anybody use it. You get better at your job, Mr. Recruiter, Mrs. Recruiter. And what you also do is just educate the software provider on how to build even better solutions going forward. So perfect, win-win-win. Let's throw some stats out there for the audience. There's a lot of people who struggle with scheduling, but because it's one of those things that we've accepted as being, of course, it's going to take this amount of time. We probably have never calculated it. It's one of those things we've just, you know, assumed it's going to be a pain in the ass. And we haven't, done any numbers on it, and we haven't thought about potential solutions. What have you discovered in sort of as you've built this product and this business, Adam, as to, you know, how much time we're spending doing scheduling, you know, what is the problem? You know, why is it so hard? You know, those types of things.
Oh, right. Let me think. So, you know, we've looked at this from both the, if you like, the candidate, the kind of recruiter perspective, but also the candidate perspective. And certainly we've recently done a big survey across, I think it's like 6,500 people who've been for an interview over the last 12 years. And this is across the US, UK, France, and Germany. And what's really fascinating is around the kind of perspective recruiters have and the challenges recruiters have around scheduling interviews, but also running that up against how the candidates see this. So certainly, you know, what we've learned is almost 2/3 of interviews involve more than one person. So, you know, there's a panel, there's at least two people in there, which you think from a recruitment, from a scheduling perspective is, you know, using a Calendly link to schedule one thing is kind of fine. It's easy. It's kind of solved. Two people, hold on. I've got to, yeah, it's that kind of square law where the complexity just kind of, it squares each time.
Becomes a three-body problem rather quickly, doesn't it?
Exactly. And all this time where you're trying to solve this problem as a recruiter, you're delaying the candidate. You're letting someone else potentially poach that candidate, who's kind of someone who's got their scheduling act in order, as it were. And we're working with customers now who, there's a big trend, certainly in engineering, to these sequences of meetings where certainly pre-pandemic, there were people were coming in. So you bring the candidate in and they may maybe top and tailing with a recruiter, but there may be three people they need to see. And the order didn't really necessarily matter. Or maybe you had panel interview at the first and then two other people they need to see. Scheduling that was an absolute nightmare. And if you talk to customers who are they're saying, well, what we do is we ask the candidate for some mornings and then we furiously go around and find people and say, well, no, candidate, please hold those three mornings, and then we'll kind of work out whether or not we can do them. Whereas if you can apply technology to that problem, that becomes, well, I'm just going to offer the candidate mornings that I know I've got a set of people that are available to do those meetings. So that's super important. And it's kind of, we looked at kind of other stats. Recruiters are, 90% are spending two or more emails or phone calls in order to set up something, which is just admin. It's just crazy that high value members of the team whose job is to get under the skin of candidates are just doing admin. So that's pretty crazy. But then there's the other side of this is around, okay, well, what does this do to the candidate perception? And in our survey, so we looked at, say, the US as an example, sort of over half of people left an interview process because scheduling just didn't happen.
Yeah, just dropped out because it's taken too long.
And that is absolutely astonishing. And that almost skews more to younger members of the population. So, you know, as an old fuddy-duddy, I'm Gen X, so which is the coolest era, I think. It's the best name. None of this millennial Gen Z business. But if you get down to kind of millennial and Gen Z, then the kind of the patience for delays falls dramatically. And really what people want is kind of that they're really citing that the key frustrations are lack of responsiveness, so communication, which is all around, often around the scheduling problems. 34% cite lack of responsiveness, 24% cite interview scheduling delays. And all these things are absolutely solvable. Now, where it's acceptable to use automation, candidates are 38% say interview scheduling, they're happy to use it. 41% say video interviewing. 40% say they're happy to do online tests. So, you know, there's an acceptance that actually no one wants to waste time, candidate or recruiter. And 64% of candidates are saying actually the interview scheduling experience affects their perception of the brand.
Yep.
And if you can just make that halfway decent, then you've saved that bad perception in 64% of people, which is it's such an easy thing to do.
Yeah, as you say, solvable problem, isn't it? And that's what it makes it even more frustrating, perhaps, because I'm sure the people chasing. You're the one solving it, so all credit to you, Adam. But I'm just thinking back in my recruiter days, chasing for people, chasing feedback, chasing whatever, and the half of the frustration was because maybe at an intuitive level we realized it was pointless. It was like, why is this like this? We can get this solved. Why is this so annoying as it is? So really good. And as you say, definitely generational challenge, because people's tolerance for delay or lack of responsiveness, you know, we're in the TikTok era, folks. You know, people are not spent, I don't know how long you spend before you abandon a YouTube video, but for me, it's like less than 3 seconds now. It's like if it's not giving me some sort of thing in that time frame, I'm bouncing. And I think with this video generation, mobile first, you know, micro content type generation, their tolerance for delay is just got shorter and shorter. And I suspect if you've got like a clunky recruiting process, that's going to definitely affect their motivation to persist through that process. And certainly if you've got a competitor that's also processing them in a more efficient way, it's obvious that you're unnecessarily, you know, switching their interest to the competition there. So yeah, fascinating how this this journey is occurring. Let's talk about the sort of exciting things that you might be looking down the pipe for this year, Adam. You've already suggested a few things just in terms of how you talk about your company. It's more at the end of the day than just this output, you know, on the calendar side. What other things could customers or prospective customers think to expect in 2021 from Chronify?
I think one thing that Chronify has done really well is we've kind of had that security and privacy focus at the heart of the company. In many ways, it's one of the benefits of being a EU-founded company. We had GDPR, but we were just before GDPR, but we knew it was coming. And so we based our entire processes off the German data privacy law, which formed the foundation of GDPR. And we're moving into a world now where, yes, it's fundamentally important, and data and where my data is stored is actually something that people have to care about, but not just companies, but individuals as well. And people are starting to care about. And that's not just in the UK, that's across the US and other jurisdictions as well. And so by having that as an underlying focus and understanding data flows and everything else that we, in everything else we do, we're in a position to really support, if you'd like, that consumer booking experience that's enterprise ready. And I think that's really, really important. And enterprise ready is not just about single sign-on. It's about a fundamental understanding of how a company operates in order to protect data. And that's both the data of the recruiters and the interview panelists, but also the candidates as well. Because, you know, this is PII, and this is something we have to be very, very careful about. And so from our perspective, it's such a core part of what we do that, you know, there's a real opportunity for us to double down on that. And certainly with our own scheduler product, that we're doing a lot of work now in terms of providing an enterprise ready scheduling experience that can either be plugged into Outlook and Gmail or be plugged into, you know, your ATS or your HR application. And so really that we're kind of doubling down on that. But also I think for us, there's an aspect around, it's kind of automation, and there's a large no code movement at the minute. So for those who don't know, no code is this idea that non-developers can start kind of joining systems together in order to automate workflows. So for example, if you have a list of candidates, you can push them to a system and it will automatically send a bunch of emails to them, but also plug that back into your ATS and send scheduling links and trigger follow-ups. And this kind of perhaps send a survey. All these things can be started to join together with services like Zapier. And so again, being an API first product, it's trivial for us to say, well, actually we can support those workflows. So you benefit from all that sort of security privacy piece, then you know that data is protected, but you can plug it into these services that allow you to orchestrate the right workflow for you. And again, this is so core to, if you think about the way products are built, product teams now in companies are building, they're kind of building again, whereas everyone went the rush to outsource, we buy SaaS and we'll just have a product that works. People are realizing that actually it forces them down workflows that aren't allowing them to differentiate, And hiring is one of those areas where actually you want more control over that workflow. So you want the flexibility to orchestrate, but solve the problems. Yeah, this plumbing, you just want solved. You want to focus on the bits that differentiate you as an organization. And so giving that capability to do that is a really, really important part of how we think about product, but also how this kind of no-code side of things allows you to solve those problems.
This is a very exciting thing because we're close, it seems. With low-code, no-code, we're close to the point where, you know, a non-technical person could stitch together via multiple sort of a library of different products a fairly significant system that could operate, that is custom to their own sort of needs, specific needs. So it's a completely different way of thinking about software where, you know, either you buy off the shelf and have to adopt your workflow to whatever the, you know, big business tells you this is how you're meant to do it. Or, you know, you ask for customizations and all this type of stuff, which, you know, you generally don't want to do on either side, because then you're locked down to something that's fixed anyway and your process can't ever change because you've locked into this way of doing, which, by the way, a lot of HR processes are actually stuck the way they are because of early commitment to a software product that they can no longer get rid of. So you lose a ton of flexibility that way. So very exciting to see what emerges from that journey. I think you're totally right to double down on this, Adam, as well, even though perhaps the return, you know, probably won't be like one of those immediate returns where, okay, brilliant, we're going to see like immediate outcomes in 3 months of getting this out. No, it's more a case of just being on trend, like long-term trend, 3, 4, 5 years down the line. This is where the world is going to be and what customers, I think, are going to demand. So really interesting.
Yeah, I think so. That is the quantified way, is to invest for the long term, like back to this idea about you build slow to go fast in the future. But also, you know, the flip side is the engineer in me gets quite nervous about almost the sellotape and string of multiple systems and different people's logins, and oh, so and so's left, so that breaks the post interview questionnaire workflow because their credentials no longer work. So it makes me nervous about that kind of things. But in terms of the experimentation and the ability to try these things, and back to what we were talking about earlier around the sort of culture of providing people a safety net with to experiment and try these things, I think the challenge is going to be, okay, well, that's great. I now know what I'd like to happen. Now, how can I make that just that little bit more robust? How can I kind of almost, okay, that bit I know is kind of fixed now. I want a software system to kind of run that bit in a stable, reliable way. So I'll just glue these two bits together. So part of the way I think about these things, the way we think about these things is, okay, so maximum experimentation, but almost you can kind of get your software system to do a bit more and we'll provide the capabilities to do that. Or as you kind of, you decide where on the stack you're happy to do more work and therefore it's potentially more brittle, but gives you that maximum flexibility. Or if you go further up the stack, but like you say, rather than being forced into right at the top, this is the way we work, or you have to build it yourself, this flexibility to sit somewhere in the line and work out what might work for your organization is going to be really, really powerful. And we're not having to think about data controls and IT sign-offs and all those kind of things.
You know what, you map these ideas on top of what is happening with, you know, companies in terms of the human relationships within companies. It just makes even more sense, because very clearly with the shift to remote, move to hybrid, let's say, back to office, you know, all these types of experimentation, one key message is coming out loud and clear is that you need to give the employees optionality, the options to choose their way of working. And that's going to trigger all kinds of like cascade effects. Everyone's going to be basically less unified in their ways of working. They're going to just produce slightly different sort of flavors, even if they had previously been in the same job. They're going to do things slightly differently and they're going to fall a little bit out of sync and probably going to need ever more custom type ways of working, which means that we're going to need more flexible ways of working with technology rather than, you know, these huge monoliths. So very interesting. Like I say, I think the arrows, I'm one of these to say, you know what, you don't need to be the most competent person in the world, which everyone who knows me knows that's definitely not the case. But it makes sense simply to be like judging the tide a little bit. And if you're like kind of going in the right, you know, with the current, so to speak, you don't need to be the best swimmer in order to get to where you need to go. Okay, let's talk about leadership. And we've got 10 minutes left in our chat. And I want to just take our folks away from product just a little bit and have a think about what you have learned in being a leader. Let's say you could like have a chat with, 20-year-old Adam, you know, pre-leadership Adam. What have you learned in your journey that you could say, you know what, this is actually quite an important lesson. Here are some things that, you know, you're going to learn them sooner or later. Learn them now.
I think the most important aspect of leadership I've learned is not to try and lead. It's to create a framework around people, to allow people to make decisions. And so one of the things we did, I kind of failed to do my previous company, was be very deliberate around culture. It just kind of evolved. We grew to about 80 people before I left. And so it was my first time kind of having an organization of that size and sort of watching from the sidelines this culture evolve, which was fine. And we were lucky that it didn't, you know, it wasn't terrible, but there was no consideration, certainly by myself, given towards it. It was like, oh, what feels right? So what we've done with Chronify is been very, very deliberate around principles. And we've chosen the word principles as opposed to values, because the principles are, it's the principles upon which we make decisions in Chronify, how we decide what we do and how we operate. Rather than, my concern with using the term values is you kind of err into judgment, being sort of judgmental. If you don't have my values, you're somehow not necessarily, you're less worthy, which most people don't use values in that way. But my concern with using that term is there's an inference there. And for me, principles is a term that's far clearer. These are the principles around which we make decisions to quantify. So what we did very, very deliberately and very carefully was involve the team in evolving and developing those principles. And it was about 4 years ago, I think, maybe even 5 years ago. And it took about 6 months of an iterative process involving the entire team and our monthly meetups back when we could meet together. In many ways, my job was editor in chief rather than these are the principles and they're going on the wall and everyone do this. And so very much so that you help the organization, the team, distill those principles down. And so we came up with 9 principles. A few years later, they got distilled down to 6 because they weren't being used. And actually, we really actively use them as a framework for working out whether we're doing things correctly. So for example, you know, we had an incident earlier on in the year where just something went wrong. Within the organization, there was and this was to do with our website. And the temptation with that principles would have been, okay, so-and-so was responsible. How can we prevent them from doing that again? Was actually the real question was, you know, back to your kind of 5 whys methodology, the having principles, okay, well, which principles applied here, and were the principles misapplied, or were the principles inappropriate? And that was a far easier discussion to the team, because rather than, oh, so and so didn't do something, it's like, okay, well, what were the principles? How, you know, what was appropriate? And it turned out that the principles had been misapplied. So actually, pragmatism on the way to perfection was one of the, it just been misapplied. Now, that was far more valuable as a team exercise in terms of empowering the team to understand, okay, so this is how we make decisions. That's a clarification of what that principle and how I should be using that principle. And that's going to improve everyone's decision-making going forward. And for me, that's leadership. It's about creating the environment for people to succeed, and having a clear framework is an important part of that. But a clear framework that is not a diktat, it's something that, you know, it's a framework that everyone is a participant in.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's so many good things to distill from that story, Adam. The consensus is kind of way of surfacing up and crystallizing what these what this framework is. But what I like most about that story is how a fail point tested the principle and tested the philosophy of using principles. So, in other words, I kind of agree with you. When you have values, they... it's hard not to avoid it being moralistic, and you know
that's what I was looking for.
What do you do with the value, right? I mean, it doesn't necessarily apply to action, other than judgment is the first action. Whereas a principle, and by the way, I think engineers in particular are very, very good at labeling. I think this may be down to some discipline in terms of, you know, making sure your taxonomy
is right. Is the hardest problem,
right? Our engineers will tell you exactly this, and we spent loads of times just basically creating the right taxonomy down, because if you're not using the right way to describe things, it can infer, it can basically create actions that you didn't intend. If you use the wrong word to describe something because you want to do it quick or whatnot, guess what, there's going to be an effect down the line where that will be either term will be deliberately misused, or new things will just start growing underneath that sort of wrong term that you'd never intended to do. So you've got to spend time doing it. So I love the fact that you thought about principles of values. How many of us have thought about that? You know, whenever we're writing, say, the culture deck, or we're trying to do some sort of cultural definition, have you thought about the words that you're using to describe it, you know, the categories? Anyway, number one, taxonomy really important. Second point was that, you know, you pull it out off the wall, so to speak, and test it. So, hey, something's happened. Let's use the framework as a tool. So it's not just like motivational stuff, you know, a rallying cry, but it's actually a tool to help you diagnose a problem and then put into place a situation where, you know, the risk of that future problem happening is minimized. So it has to be actively used. And you're right in the final point, Adam, in the sense that once people have done it this way, you might actually habituate the team to keep using the framework. And that's how you really reinforce the culture going forward.
Yes, the team have to own the framework completely.
And you didn't know this at 20 years old, Adam.
There's a lot I didn't know at 20 years old, but I felt that was the most relevant to this conversation.
Excellent. in terms of your learning as a leader, was it all on the job? I mean, I guess most of it must have been, given the fact that, you know, the business grew up and you were the person that started those businesses and again. Or was there some source, or was there somebody that helped, or did you seek guidance in any other way?
It was primarily on the job. I've been lucky that certainly I've grown up in the era of the internet. So I was using a Mosaic browser on the Sun workstation at university. The notion of information being available has just been part of, and so there's a natural tendency for me to go and look for information. And with the kind of explosion of blogging, as I became more aware of what I needed to be doing as a leader, that happily coincided with explosion of information about leadership. I've used an executive coach for a while, which was interesting. But I guess more recently, I found a mentor who actually I ended up inviting as chairman of Chronify. There's a kind of mutual respect there, and also an honesty, and I can say things and you'll go, really, you sure? And that's incredibly powerful, this idea, and being that kind of vulnerable with someone, knowing that they're not going to judge you. And I think that finding that, but it took me a long time. And I guess that's the other thing. Perhaps I should have tried to find that sooner. I think I'd probably been more successful as a leader had I done that.
I think that's actually a very normal thing, though, for a CEO in the path that you've gone up to, Adam, in the sense that you'll find yourself in a position where you can't be vulnerable, even if the mantra currently says you should be. But as a CEO, you have a responsibility is different from you being a person. You have to represent the business.
No, we're people too.
Well, you are. But you know what I mean? It's like there's different pressures. I mean, that's the reality of it. Other people look up to you. The things you say have different types of impact compared to if you were just another employee. So,
That was a real realization, something I didn't really appreciate, is the power of the founders. Yeah. Something I threw out an idea and suddenly it became mandate. And it's like, no, that's not what I meant. It was just an idea.
It has gravity. And it's good and bad, right? It's good and bad, because you then have to then be very, very careful with how you speak, and very, very you train yourself to do that. And that's the opposite side of vulnerability, where you don't have that type of filtering. So I think the presence of exec coaching, I think, is got to be something that if you're a CEO right now or thinking about being a CEO, you need to think about that straight away, because having someone on the outside that isn't impacted by your decision making, giving you input, I think, is critical, because everyone else is impacted by your thoughts. So inevitably, they are thinking that when they're having chats with you. So very, very interesting. Adam, I could keep talking with you for a long time, it seems, but I'm very conscious of your time. So I don't want to burn too much of it. Couple of questions, like from the left field, not left field, but, you know, from the outside. Big news actually happened last couple of days. Google versus Oracle. Have you been monitoring this?
I've caught a few headlines, but it's one of those things I need to read up.
So I just read up on it this morning. But folks, if you didn't know, basically Oracle was suing Google for copywriting API, something like that, on Java. Right, okay. So when Google basically were developing, or, you know, they bought and developed Android, they used, I think, an API from Oracle in order to do that. And the big decision was, can you actually copyright APIs? Which I think actually has huge implications, depending on how that goes, right? But anyway, it looks like Google have won that, which I believe is a positive thing. Would you agree that's a good thing? Or would you side on the side of Oracle here, saying, this is our API, you can't actually copy it?
Protectionism needs to be used incredibly carefully. And the whole notion of patents and copyright is something that I'm not a kind of libertarian, freedom of everything, everyone, you know, kind of free marketeer, because I don't think that's the best way to be fair to everyone. The idea of copywriting an API, and I'm kind of shooting a bit from the hip on this, because it's one of those headlines I've been meaning to read. But really, all you're doing from an API perspective is an interface. And you're saying, actually, I'm saying, right, this is the language that these two software systems are going to talk. And can you imagine copywriting a language to saying, you can't communicate in this language? That feels crazy and feels incredibly protectionist. And given it was Oracle suing someone else, probably lends its
way. Half of the course.
Yeah, absolutely. But the whole foundation of the internet is based on APIs that anyone can use. The reason we're talking today is based on open APIs. The reason the web pages are delivered is based on open APIs. People have agreed a standard, a language of communication between the browser and a web server. And so, it would stagger me if there was the second order impacts of that decision, if it went against Google, would be immense for the availability of all sorts of services on the internet and the ability for innovation to happen fundamentally.
Yep, we would have slowed down innovation like massively. And by the way, this is based on one dude. It was a dude, obviously, made that decision. It's incredible to me that person can have such an impact on things that will have generational impact potentially. If you're talking about things of this type, judges in charge of these types of cases oftentimes, no disrespect to people who are like older, you and I are on that journey, everyone's on that journey, but a lot of these people basically earn their professional spurs in the pre-internet era, and you would imagine, okay, are they really that qualified to make this decision? Thank God, I think this decision was made in the right way, but it could have just gone the other side, right? So incredible how that was.
And I guess it would only apply to the US. So yes, the US is a big market, but there's a lot of else in the world. And we're in the software industry, we're quite obsessed with the US, and you know, rightly so. There's a massive opportunity. It represents a large chunk of Chronify's business, but there is a rest of the world as well. The danger is the precedent that, okay, so someone's made a reasoned decision and they'll set out their reasoning for their decision, which then another judge somewhere else in another jurisdiction can then make a ruling based on, okay, well, that's the precedent, if you like. And so many of our legal systems are based on that precedent.
Yeah, crazy stuff, but quite right to remind us that the US domination of the discourse doesn't necessarily map, obviously, to the reality on the ground. And that's something that I think we definitely need to be much more conscious of. Okay, final couple of questions. These are yes-nos because we've got no more time, Adam. Blockchain, is it a fad or is it the next? Is it digital gold? How do you go?
I think it can be used to solve specific problems. It's a technology in the same way that databases are a technology. It's a different way of storing information that has good sides and bad sides. I think you need to separate out blockchain from cryptocurrency. Cryptocurrency is an application of blockchain. I think there's some really interesting applications of blockchain for example, property ownership, understanding whether someone actually owns a plot of land in a way that doesn't rely on a centralized governmental control has a lot of really interesting implications for development of economies in, say, Africa, as an example.
Yeah, very, very good. Okay, final couple ones.
Sorry, that wasn't a yes or a no. Sorry.
Doesn't matter. I think you're saying digital gold. I'll just shove you into that bucket, Adam. All right. What about UBI, Universal Basic Income? Good idea or not? That's a yes, no.
These aren't really yes, no questions. I absolutely think there's a role in the state to provide for people. Absolutely. I'm a firm believer in the state's role in supporting society. Whether the tactic for doing that is UBI, I don't know yet. But certainly I think there's I absolutely believe that the state should be supporting everyone, because we all benefit if everyone's supported.
Excellent. Final question for you. Leadership. The two of the probably most prominent leaders in technology these days, they both attract all kinds of like opinions, most of them negative, I think. But what are your views on Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos? Of the two leaders there, which one would you say, yeah, that's probably closer to how I would do things if I could? No need to explain, Adam. This is like one or the other.
I would probably say Elon Musk without the craziness. I like to say I'm kind of more earth-centered than Musk, but maybe that's the problem.
I think both of them are off the planet, aren't they? Literally, in terms of their ambitions.
I think the ruthlessness of Bezos is something I can't quite subscribe to.
Right. That would actually be a lot of reasons why people do admire Bezos, because he is so lasered focused on it. But okay, Adam, I've burned huge amounts of your time. Thank you so much for it. Really enjoyable to have a conversation with you, learn more about you and your business and your vision for your company. So if people did want to find out a bit more about you and Chronify, how do they do that, Adam?
Chronify.com. Chronofy.com.
There we go, folks. I will share that link to everyone in the follow-up. But thank you, Adam Bird. Great to have you on Founders Focus.
That way. Thanks, man. Great to meet you.
What a great show. What a great guy. Okay, folks, that was Adam Bird. If you have a problem with scheduling or you want to improve your workflow, you need to check out Chronify, chronify.com. Okay, we'll be back with Founders Focus. I think we're back next week. We've got a really exciting show there. Brain Food Live this Friday, of course. That is happening as normal. We've got a short week, but we're going to pack a lot of stuff in. So follow the channel if you're interested in this type of conversational content. See you later this week.